the greatest killer. As a mission to persecute church and also as part of the Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism, we want to get the real news. What is the greatest killer? At this moment, there are celebrations all over China, apparently, for 70 years of communism in China. October 2019 marks 70 years since the Communist Party seized power in China. And my question is, well, what actually is there to celebrate? And they might be shooting up a lot of flares and having a lot of fireworks and big performances and some speeches. But you kind of notice there's a regimentation and a predominance of a certain color and only one type of flag with a hammer and sickle on it. And this obscenely large picture of Chairman Mao, real talk about ancestor worship and idolatry. I don't know if you've noticed, but those of the Communist Party leaders up top who wear in ties, they're all red ties. Isn't that kind of... There's no individuality, it seems, out there. There's just a conformity. So what is the true legacy of communism in the world's most populous nation? China has more people than any other single nation. 1.3 billion people. And what can we learn from the persecuted church? Do you know, when I was first converted, 1977, in Pines Baptist, shortly after I was converted, a missionary came past from Operation Overseas Missionary Fellowship, OMF. And OMF used to be the China Inland Mission. In fact, she was basically informing us that China Inland Mission had to change its name to OMF because they're not allowed to work in China anymore. And there's no work being done in China because all missionaries are banned. And so they had to change the name to Overseas Missionary Fellowship. And one of the things he asked was, pray for the doors to China to be open again. In 1977, I must say, I thought the man was off the wall. And when we bowed to pray, I didn't pray because I had no faith whatsoever that the door to China would ever be open again. I mean, China was closed. China was communist, just like the Berlin Wall would never fall in my lifetime. I mean, that was reality. That was consensus back in the 1970s. It just seemed impossible. There had been something in a region of 2.7 million Christians in China at the takeover of the communists. 2.7 million, possibly up to 3 million, and they were all wiped out. As far as they knew, there was no Christians left alive after the communists took over. They wiped them all out. And 1977, we didn't know if there was even a church in China. And the word came out shortly afterwards. You know, there could be as many as 20 million. 20 million Christians in China. Then it was 30 million. Then we heard about 60 million, and then 100 million. And according to the latest Operation World, 105 million Christians in China today, of which 75 million are church members, officially. Staggering. The growth of the church in China, how on earth have they survived? There are some dramatic developments and very encouraging reports of spectacular growth of the church in China, despite having one of the worst, most oppressive communist dictatorships on the planet. Jesus said, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Now some, not us, we don't celebrate, but as some celebrate 7 years of communism in China, and as incredible numbers of Christians in the West identify themselves as Christian socialists. I, this year, at Christian events, had people walking up to me and saying, I'm a Christian socialist. And I'd say, that's sort of like being a God-fearing atheist. It's an oxymoron. You can't put those two together, like oil and water don't mix. And I've even met Christians who claim to be communists. It's necessary we take an objective look at the catastrophic consequences of communism. We need to be aware of the human cost of communist economic and social theories and the application in communist states which espouse the goodness of man. They say they believe in the goodness of man, but do they do some inhuman things? The Communist Revolution of China in 1949... 7 years ago, was followed by the Great Leap Forward in 1958 and by the second phase of the revolution from 1966 through to 1976. The second phase of the revolution, or the Cultural Revolution, as it was actually an anti-cultural revolution, but Mao liked to call it the Cultural Revolution, It included mass seizures of power and property, widespread land reform, confiscation without compensation. And there were public humiliation ceremonies of religious and cultural leaders. Could be teachers, professors, pastors, bishops. They're forced to stand with signs like lackey of the running dogs, colonialist, imperialist, fascist, reactionary, counter-revolutionary, other sort of terms. And they'd have to bow with degrading hats. Sometimes you can see the blood on them from being beaten. And they'd have to stand or bow in front of TV cameras and all that, in big stadiums, to be humiliated publicly before they were beaten to death or executed. And all of this was part of the Cultural Revolution. Arbitrary imprisonments, hard labor, torture, mass executions with Western weapons, as you can see, American Tommy guns and so on here. People being shot in the back. It's calculated that over 69 million people died in the second phase of the revolution in China. I ask again, what are we celebrating? The Cultural Revolution in China even included purging the party, there was only one party, the Communist Party, of any deemed disloyal, which even included the president of the country, who was president of the Communist Party too, Liu Shaoqi. How could he be disloyal to the party? He's the president. And the military commander, General Liu Ruiqing, he was also deemed disloyal and executed. Chairman Mao seized complete power. So this was, here he's got, to his left and to his right, the people he's about to kill in the Great Communist Revolution. See what they're holding up? They're holding up their Communist Party membership book, which has got their details, which of course would stamp every party congress and meeting you go to and things like this. So purging the party meant even the president and the military commander were not exempt from being purged. Chairman Mao ruled China with an iron fist. One man, one vote. Just one man had the vote. Mao Zedong mobilized his Red Guards to sweep into every farm and every village in the vast country. And he mobilized his Red Guards to purge reactionaries and counter-revolutionaries and anyone else deemed not sufficiently enthusiastic for the revolution. The first was called the Great Leap Forward, and the second phase was called the Cultural Revolution, so-called Cultural Revolution. By the way, when you see these enthusiastic artworks, this is such classic communist artworks, and in fact, when you look at the propaganda, why must they use artwork? I was told by an artist who worked for the Cape Times and the Argus that when you see in a advertising of property, artwork instead of photograph, it's because the place is such a mess, they needed an artist to make it look good, because no photograph could be attractive. And so when the communists show these great productivity and all that, and happy people like this, why are they using artwork in this case? Because no photographs existed of such. This is the kind of Great Leap Forward. Notice they're sort of surfing the dragon, and look at these bountiful harvests and these happy workers and growth and happy people, and except that it didn't happen. You know, all these nice, happy farm workers and happy children with beautiful lawn and 5-year plan fulfilled and bumper crops and more tractors than ever before. But it's just fiction. The result was the destruction of thousands of years of culture and crippling the country economically. It impoverished China intellectually. It impoverished China culturally. And this is what it was, the sledgehammer being used to smash all dissent. The result was this temple being turned into a communist atheistic shrine. It used to be a Buddhist temple. And of course this is what did it to churches, other cultural centers, religious centers. Mao was able to mobilize the young Red Guards for this destructive campaign because they were all under the age of 18. They had never lived in nationalist China. They had been effectively indoctrinated in the state schools with Marxist propaganda and Mao's Little Red Book, which they treated like a Bible. In fact, when I was locked up in Zambia in 1987, Kenneth Kaunda's regime was very under the influence of the Chinese. At one of the interrogations where I actually asked, when my head wasn't in buckets of water and filth and so on, if I could get my Bible back, I could see my Bible sitting on the table behind this man, and he didn't even look at it. He pulled out his Little Red Book and he said, "I'll give you Mao's Little Red Book." And I flicked through a bit of it and I said, "You know, Mao never rose from the dead. He didn't walk on water. He can't forgive sins. He's not coming again to judge the living and dead. And I gave him back his book. Well, you can imagine what happened to me in my head. But the little red book, that was their Bible. I heard a ZANU-PF soldier in Zimbabwe in 1982, when I was evangelizing, he said, "ZANU is my church. Mugabe is my God. A little red book is my Bible. My soul belongs to the party forever." Maybe it does. But Jesus could set the captive free and break those chains. Here's the memoirs of a young girl who was one of the Red Guard, one of the Red Scarf girls, members of the Cultural Revolution. It hasn't stopped. They're still shooting people in the back of the head. This is communism in China. What is there to celebrate about China's 7 years of communism? Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they've practiced deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. The way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. The 20th century was the bloodiest century in all of history. Now, this may be a surprise to people who believe in evolutionism, that everything is getting better and better, but humanism has proved to be the most destructive religion of all time. When people want to say more people have died in the name of religion than any other, you can say, that's true, when you recognize that atheism is a religion. Atheism is the most destructive, bloody religion in history. They've even killed more people than Islam, although that's quite an amazing thing to have even beaten Islam at a mass murder. Far more people have been killed in the name of atheism than by all other religions combined. You can add the Spanish Inquisition, Roman Catholicism, Islam. Atheism has killed even more. And this is just the 20th century statistics. By the way, these statistics here in this chart comes from the Global Church, written by Patrick Johnson, who did the Operation World book. Historian Paul Johnson observed the 20th century has proved itself the greatest killer of all time. The 20th century saw the worst atrocities ever committed in the history of the world. Forget Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun and Shaka Zulu. I mean, honestly, they were beginners and amateurs compared to the mass murderers of the 20th century. The word genocide, a term coined in the 20th century, speaking about the Turkish Islamic Jihad destroying the lives of millions of Christians, the Armenian genocide, the Greek genocide, the Assyrian genocide. This describes what has occurred repeatedly in secular humanist states which first disarmed their populations. Darwinian evolutionism, with its survival of the fittest ideology, has devalued human life. Darwin's Deadly Legacy is the name of one of the videos produced by James Kendi's ministry and well worth a watch. If man is not created in the image of God, and if there's no God in heaven who will judge the living and the dead, if there's no objective standards of right and wrong, then life becomes cheap. All life. When you devalue God, you devalue life. What gives life dignity? Being created by God. In fact, I've argued this with our animal rights people marching to Parliament, protesting about canned lion hunting, rhino poaching, and other things like this. And I've said to them, why are you marching? Because animals matter. But why? Because animals matter. I said, well, I've got more reason to march than you, because I believe in a creator God who has made all the creatures, who is the God of all the animals, and all the animals belong to him. When I recognize who they belong to and that I'm accountable to God for how I treat them, I've got a good, eternal, objective reason for caring for God's creation. What reason do you have? And all I could say was, animals matter. Why? Because animals matter. They don't have a foundation, because if we just matter in motion, cosmic accident, from molecules to mud to monkeys to man, then there's no value of human or animal life. Who are people, according to atheists, to believe in evolution? A hairless ape is the way Schoenberg put it. A mere insect, an ant, said Church. A twig. An accidental twig, not even just a twig, but an accidental twig, according to Gold. Nietzsche said, a rope stretched over an abyss. De Maria put it, a fungus on the surface of one of the minor planets. Like just bacteria, like a bit of slime or moss on a rock. A jest, a dream, a show, bubble air, said Thornbury. Oliver Wendell Holmes, a famous humanist, said, I see no reason for attributing to man a significant difference in kind from that which belongs to a grain of sand. There's no more value for life than a grain of sand. Does that make sense to anyone? Psalm 14 verse 1 says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. Their deeds are vile. There is no one who does good. When you start off saying there's no God, the consequences are horrific. When atheism takes hold of a society like the famous Voltaire, who was the sort of Karl Marx that led to the French Revolution, when atheism takes hold of a society, moral relativism is inevitable. Nothing is sacred. There's no objective standard of right and wrong. There's no God. There's no eternal day of judgment. There's no hope of eternal justice. Everything becomes cheap. As the existentialist writer Jean-Paul Sartre explained, without God, all activities are equivalent. Thus, it amounts to the same thing, whether one gets drunk alone or is the leader of nations. There's no moral distinctives. Historian Paul Johnson commented on the advance of atheism in modern history. Nietzsche wrote in 1886, the greatest event of recent times, that God is dead, that the belief in the Christian God is no longer tenable, is beginning to cast its first shadows over Europe. There is no God. That's a Nietzsche statement. Ultimately, the collapse of the religious impulse would leave a huge vacuum. The history of modern times is a great part, the history of how that vacuum's been filled. What has filled the vacuum that was taken by God and his church and his word and his worship in the ancient world? Dr. James Kennedy and Jerry Newcomb in What If Jesus Had Never Been Born book observed, the vacuum has been filled with a totalitarian state, with a loss of freedom for millions, with a concentration camp and the gulag. The rise of abortion, infanticide, euthanasia and suicide, crime out of all proportions, and the most savage wars in the history of the world. That's what's filled the vacuum in the 20th century, which is why the 20th century is the worst century in the history of mankind, especially for the persecuted church. More Christians have been persecuted in the 20th century, have died for Christ in the 20th century than all previous 19th centuries combined. The triumph of the secular humanist, with its atheism, evolutionism, its situation ethics, has led to the rise of gangster statesmen such as Vladimir Lenin and Joseph Stalin, Mao Tse-tung, Fidel Castro, Pol Pot, Robert Mugabe, and many others like them. Socialism has ideas so good it's just got to be mandatory. And remember what Vladimir Lenin said? The goal of socialism is communism. What was it? The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And this is what many people mistake. Some people say, oh no, I'm not a communist, I'm a socialist. But the goal of socialism is communism. Vladimir Lenin famously declared, it does not matter if 3/4 of the population of Russia perish, as long as the remaining quarter are communist. Well, how's that for your, you know, mind of matter? I don't mind, you don't matter. You know, that kind of idea. At least 180 million people were killed by secular governments in the 20th century. And that's a very conservative estimate. We're not here talking about people who died in the wars caused by secular humanist states, because that would massively increase the body count. No, we're talking about 180 million people were killed by their own secular humanist governments in the 20th century. The greatest threat to life in the 20th century has not been firearm accidents or crime, not even wars. More people were killed by their own governments in peace than were killed by foreign invaders in wartime. You think war is bad? Peace can be worse in a communist country. Dr. David Barrett, editor of the massive Christian World Encyclopedia, which is that big, thick, red book on the shelf there, just above where Justin's sitting, that book, which cost me almost a month's wages to buy back in 1980, author of Cosmos, Chaos and the Gospel, Our Globe and How to Reach It, David Barrett, one of the greatest missiologists in the world today, says that the Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin was responsible for killing over 40 million people. Well, that he estimated in 1980. Alexander Solzhenitsyn in the 1990s calculated the Soviet death toll at over 66 million. He had access to far more documentation once the Berlin Wall went down, the Soviet archives were opened. Joseph Stalin closed down, confiscated, or destroyed over 49,000 churches. Out of 50,000 churches in Russia in 1917, there weren't even 200 left by 1941. And Stalin attempted the liquidation of the entire Christian church. Thankfully, helped by leaders of the free world, Winston Churchill and FDR, who used the arsenal of democracy to save the Soviet Union, paid for by South African gold, which Jan Smuts, Prime Minister of South Africa, not that he is elected, he had done a coup d'etat to remove our elected Prime Minister, James Barry Hertog, who had been elected 5 times in succession, each time against Smuts. Smuts hadn't won an election. Hertog hadn't lost an election, most popular Prime Minister in South Africa's history. Hertog refused to declare war on Germany in 1939. So he just was removed in a palace coup, so to speak, by Smuts, who, without a referendum, without going to the people at all, then took a message from Winston Churchill, take all the gold above ground in South Africa, ship it to Simonstown, the U.S. Quincy is coming to Simonstown, load at night in utmost secrecy all the gold that South Africa has onto the U.S. Quincy. This battle cruiser will take it back to New York, and when he has it, it'll unleash Lend-Lease, where they will start to provide Britain, and presumably we weren't told, vast amounts of trillions of dollars worth of weaponry and high-tech equipment to the Soviet Union to save the Soviet Union. South African gold, American technology, saved the Soviet Union to be able to liquidate a few tens of millions more Christians. That's what the arsenal of democracy and the free world did to preserve freedom. Similarly, communist dictator of China, Mao Zedong, launched the great proletarian cultural revolution, history's most systematic attempt ever by a single nation to eradicate and destroy Christianity. The greatest anti-Christian persecution in the history of the world. Again, I'm quoting from David Barrett. Mao Zedong was responsible for killing about 72 million people. He's in the Guinness Book of Records as the world's greatest killer of all time. The communist takeover of Cambodia in 1975 resulted in the death of up to 3 million people. A full third of the total population, the killing fields of Cambodia. When you add to these the death toll of communist regimes in Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Angola, Mozambique, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Cuba, and Zimbabwe, the body count is staggering. As Dostoevsky so eloquently put it, if God is dead, then all things are permissible. The terrifying thing about secular humanism is there's no authority above the state to which you can make an appeal. The first thing Nelson Mandela did when he became president of South Africa is to abolish prayer in parliament. Wouldn't even allow a 1 minute silence, because that would acknowledge a high source of authority. And so as a consistent member of the Politburo of the Communist Party of South Africa, no minute of silence, no prayer in parliament. We'd had 127 years of non-stop opening parliament and prayer in Cape Town. And then suddenly in 1994, nothing. Not even a minute of silence. Why? There's no higher source of authority than the government. The party is infallible. And in fact, our constitution even states that. The Southern Constitution states there is no authority higher than that of the Southern Constitution. With all its spelling errors, grammatical errors, being agreed to at about 2 or 3 in the morning when everyone is tired and just want to go home. This full of compromises and so on. Unbelievable. They really think that it's any other source of law or authority incompatible with the Southern Constitution is invalid and no authority at all, says the Southern Constitution. Well, we don't believe that. The concept of inalienable rights endowed by Creator are impossible in a secular state, because secular state is the highest authority. They don't want to acknowledge a highest authority above themselves. If the state itself is the highest authority, there's no limits to the abuses and oppression that unrestrained human nature is capable of. The humanist state inevitably leads to tyranny and despotism. The publication of the Black Book of Communism created a sensation. First published in French and later translated into English. I see we've got it right in the shelf up there, Black Book of Communism. Doorstopper. You can drop it on a liberal's foot and he will limp. The Black Book is a scholarly, detailed account of the crimes of communism, starting with the Russian Revolution, the Soviet Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, continuing through Eastern Europe, Red China, North Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Angola, and Afghanistan. At almost 900 pages long, the Black Book's exhaustive indictment of communism is all the more compelling because all six of its authors were once communists. They were researchers, professors, and journalists associated with the Paris-based Center for the Study of History and Sociology of Communism. The editor of the Black Book, Stéphane Courtier, was the editor of the Communisme magazine, the main magazine of the Communist Party of France. As the foreword declares, 10 years ago, the authors of the Black Book would have refused to believe what they now write. However, the exploration of the Soviet archives, which were opened up after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, forced them out of a duty of remembrance to the millions of victims murdered under Marxist regimes to spare a little compassion for the victims of the inhumanity so long meted out by so many of their own partisans. Their intention was that the Black Book serve as both history and as a memorial to those victims whose very memory has been wiped out. Hollywood's not making films on any victims of communism. They don't care about victims of communism, as many of them are Christians. In his introduction, Stéphane Courtier declares, "The fact remains that our century, the 20th century, has outdone its predecessors in its bloodthirstiness. Indeed, communism occupies one of the most violent and most significant places of all." The Black Book indicts the Soviet Union's communist leaders for the following crimes, amongst many others. The execution without trial of tens of thousands of hostages and prisoners and the murder of hundreds of thousands of workers and peasants. They distinguish between factory workers in urban areas and peasants who farm labourers. In Russia from 1918 to 1922 under Vladimir Lenin. Vladimir Lenin was not a benign dictator. He was as brutal as Stalin, he just didn't live as long. Deliberately destroying all food and crops so as to starve to death 5 million people in Russia just in 1922 alone. It's not the Holodomor of Ukraine, that's coming later. The extermination of the Cossacks in 1920. This is a tribe of great horsemen who are the main cavalrymen of the Russian Tsars for centuries. The liquidation of 690,000 people in the Great Purge of 1937 to 1938. Although, to be honest, this is one that I'm not so concerned about because that Great Purge was killing communists who they thought weren't loyal enough. So they were killing revolutionaries who had already killed a whole lot of other people. So basically, this was what you sow is what you reap. The destruction of 4 million Ukrainians and 2 million other people in a man-made, systematically perpetrated dekulakization famine of 1932 to 1933. The Black Book presents a very conservative estimate of the number of civilians murdered by Marxist regimes based on the Marxist regime's own records. So this is the limit. Black Book communism only is taken from the communist own archives. 20 million in the Soviet Union, 65 million in Red China, 1 million Vietnam, 2 million North Korea, 2 million Cambodia, 1.5 million Afghanistan, and so on. Now, other statistics will be much larger, but they were limiting themselves to just the communist own records. The Black Book of Communism documents that according to the communist regime's own archive, the death toll is at least 100 million people killed by communist governments between 1917 and 1991. These crimes tend to fit a recognizable pattern. The pattern includes execution by firing squads, hanging, drowning, battering, gassing, poisoning, car accidents, destruction of the population by starvation through man-made famine, withholding of food or both, deportation, through which death can occur in transit, either through physical exhaustion or through confinement in enclosed spaces, like cattle trucks and railway trucks, through forced labour, where they are worked to death through exhaustion, illness, hunger, cold, arctic hell holes of Siberia. Thus, in the name of an ideological belief system, communism, were tens of millions of innocent victims systematically butchered. The foreword to the Black Book declares, communism has been the great story of the 20th century, bursting into history from the most unlikely corner of Europe amid the trauma of World War I. In the wake of a cataclysm of 1939 to 1945, it made a giant leap westwards and even greater one eastward to the China Seas. The Second World War effectively removed the two obstacles to the spread of communism. The most anti-communist country in Europe, Germany, most anti-communist country in Asia, Japan, both removed, which enabled the communists to take over Eastern Europe, China, North Korea, and so on. With this feat, communism had come to rule a third of mankind and seemed poised to advance indefinitely. For seven decades, it haunted world politics, polarizing opinion between those who saw it as the socialist end of history and those who considered it as history's most total tyranny. The Bolshevik Revolution 1917 seized political control of the country from the Duma, the Parliament of Russia. It is false to say that Lenin overthrew the Tsar, that the Bolshevik Revolution overthrew the Tsarist rule in Russia. That's absolute lie. The Duma, the Parliament of Russia, removed the Tsar. The Communist Revolution removed the Parliament. But that doesn't make a nice story. It upsets the narrative. So who wants the facts to interfere with a good story? And so they just continue to speak about how Lenin overthrew the Tsar, the Bolshevik Revolution overthrew Tsarist Russia. Not so. 12 years later, in December 1929, Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin announced the liquidation of the kulaks, that's the farmers, as a class. Now we have the opportunity to carry out a resolute offensive against the kulaks to break their resistance, to eliminate them. The kulaks were farmers. Dekulakization was presented as land reform. The official state newspaper Pravda, which means truth, declared in order to eliminate the kulaks as a class, the resistance of this class must be smashed in open battle. It must be deprived of the productive sources of its existence and development. The free use of land, instruments of production, land renting, right to high labour, and so on. That is the term towards the policy of eliminating the kulaks as a class. Here, they were burning the forests by the farms because the farmers fled into the forests when the communists came to deport them. And so they said, well, we'll burn down the forest and burn them within it. Just imagine the destruction this causes. This is some of the subtle artwork of that time, showing the hammer and sickle smashing the head of the farmer, whose time is running out. You can see that's they're kind of this 1930s artwork. Under this dekulakization policy, 18 million peasants lost their homes and farms. Millions were deported to Siberia, which is an Arctic hellhole in the winter. And this was known, even in Chicago. Hunger, despair, death in Ukraine, agony. And yet, just a few years later, America was shipping billions of dollars of weaponry to the Soviet Union to save the very regime that had slaughtered millions of their own people. Here, the KGB, or at this stage, they would be called the NKVD, were going under barns and finding the grain that farmers had hoarded, which is a capital crime. Up to 11 million Ukrainians died in the massacres and resulting man-made famine between 1929 and 1936. This is a picture of the famine, the Holodomor, in Ukraine. This came to be called the Holodomor, also known as the Great Famine, the Ukrainian Genocide, 1932 to 1933. The word Holodomor, literally translated from Ukrainian, means death by hunger or to kill by hunger or to starve to death. It comes from a compound of two Ukrainian words, holod, meaning hunger, and mor, meaning plague. So hunger plague. The memorial in Ukraine to the victims of the Holodomor. The 2017 film Bitter Harvest, which we showed at our 2018 GCC, dramatizes the horrors of the Soviet Holodomor in Ukraine. Well made, and what I like about this film is its spirit of resistance. It's not just on the victims. It's on victims resisting and fighting back, and it gives hope. And that's what makes it, I think, so effective. Made by Ukrainians in Canada. Well done, film. This Black Book of Communism provides further documentation of the systematic extermination of farmers in Ukraine, which was once called the breadbasket of Europe. This was followed by the Great Purge or Great Terror, in which 950,000 Russians were killed by the Soviet secret police, the NKVD, which later morphed into the KGB. This included many Communist Party members and government officials, many officers of the Red Army, and so one can only say, well, what you sow is what you reap. Ultimately, even Leon Trotsky, who was born Lev Davidovich Bronstein, the Soviet hero of the revolution, who was in the Bronx in New York when the revolution occurred and then recruited a whole lot of fellow Bronx New York Jew Americans to go over and form the core of the Red Army, who slaughtered millions of Christians. He ended up literally axed, killed with an ice axe in Mexico City, 20th of August 1940, showing that you can even flee to another hemisphere and continent, the NKVD will get you there. And he was one of the heroes of the revolution. If you've read Animal Farm, you'll immediately recognize that Trotsky is the inspiration for Snowball, who's the hero of the Animal Farm revolution. And Stalin is Napoleon, the inspiration for Napoleon, the pig who sends his dogs after Snowball. And so, you know, this is the hero of the revolution, so-called. But there's no gratitude because communism is cannibalistic. They end up killing their own. With socialist fables of their workers' paradise now consigned to what Trotsky had called the ash heap of history, it now has to be admitted, I'm quoting from Black Book Communism, that the secular human state has been a tragedy of planetary dimensions. The communist record offers the most colossal case of political carnage in history. Now, bear in mind, this isn't Peter Hammond writing here. This is Stefan Cortier. This is the editor of Communisme. This is a Communist Party member of the Communist Party in France writing this. This is what makes it so staggering. As the Black Book documents, communist states did not merely commit criminal acts. They were criminal enterprises in their very essence, on principle, so to speak. They ruled lawlessly by violence and without regard to human life. I say that the Zimbabwe regime of ZANU-PF has been a criminal enterprise from day one. And the ANC has been a criminal enterprise from day one. All communist regimes, Fidel Castro's in Cuba, they all are criminal enterprises in their very essence. They're modeled on the original criminal enterprise. What is also remarkable is that these atrocities were committed by regimes who claimed they were building a workers' paradise. Quote, unquote, workers' paradise. They were creating heaven on earth. But rather than delivering paradise, all they succeeded in doing was delivering perdition, hell on earth. Lord Acton of the French Revolution made this comment, power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Although governments are meant to protect their citizens, secular states in the 20th century murdered over 170 million of their own citizens. And that astonishing statistic is a result of decades of research by political science professor R.J. Rummel of the University of Hawaii. Professor Rummel's shocking research is presented in the 500-page book Death by Government, published in 2006. The charts and the statistics measuring the life-taking propensities of state governments were developed from the professor's analysis of 8,200 sources involving over 4,200 consultations and calculations, which were organized into appendix tables totaling more than 18,000 rows. This man is a statistician of note. Just one appendix table alone amounted to over 50 pages and is provided in a supplementary volume, Statistics of Democide, Estimates, Sources, and Calculations on 20th Century Genocide and Mass Murder. Professor Rummel coined the term democide for mass murder by governments. Professor Rummel notes that textbooks on political science need to be modernized to recognize political realities. While most textbooks refer to the functions of government as law and order, safety and security, cultural maintenance, social worker. I mean, look at these happy, benign, lying, pathetic, false images on these textbooks. Is that really political science? I've been showing you other images of the reality of politics, but this is what the textbooks are trying to give. And people getting a degree in political science at the University of Cape Town or something, they've had their minds filled with a lot of rubbish that's got nothing to do with the reality of what governments really do. The fact is, I'm quoting from Professor Rummel, we have numerous examples of governments that kills hundreds of thousands and even millions of their own citizens, enslaved the rest, and abolished traditional culture. There is the common and fundamental justification of government that it exists to protect citizens against an anarchic jungle that would otherwise threaten their lives and property. Such archaic or sterile views shows no appreciation of democide's existence and is all the related horrors and suffering. They are inconsistent with a regime that stands astride society like a gang of thugs over hikers they've captured in the woods, robbing all, raping some, torturing others for fun, murdering others they don't like, and terrorizing the rest into servile obedience. This exact characterization of many past and present governments, such as Idi Amin's in Uganda, hardly squares with conventional political science. Do they teach reality in these political science, or are they just giving them fairy tales? One excellent Christian documentary on this, and we plan to show the film Tortured for Christ in the run-up to International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. Excellent dramatic film that's come out recently. Richard Vorman's book, Tortured for Christ, really is invaluable. Richard Vorman documents how he was tortured by people who said, I thank the God I don't believe in, that I have the power to give vent to all the evil in my heart without any restraint. And so he was being tortured by atheists and communists for no reason except for the fact that they enjoyed causing torture to Christians. And what he documented in the scars in his body, suffered for 14 years in communist concentration camps and prison camps, in solitary confinement for over 4 of those years. And the tortures he revealed what's in the minds of these communists. And I've heard myself from people who were victims in communist camps saying, why don't you just kill us and get it over with? And the communists said, oh no, we don't want to kill you and send you to heaven with God. We want you to curse Christ and come to hell with us for all eternity. I've heard that quote from more than one source. I think that gets to the heart of it. You don't understand communism until you understand that Karl Marx was a Satanist, which was a key part of what we were sharing last week on the heart and soul of Karl Marx. Professor Rummel observes that while library stacks have been written on the possible nature and consequence of nuclear war and how nuclear war could be avoided, the reality is up to 360 million civilians have been slaughtered by their own governments just in the 20th century. Now you may wonder why we're getting different statistics here. Well, different people, different methods, looking at things in different ways. Now, the Black Book Communism was limited to the communist-owned archives and so on. But you'll see where Professor Rummel's getting this from when you get into his book. Yet very few books have dealt with the overall human cost of government, death by government, the Black Book of Communism being one exception. Again, quoting from Professor Rummel. Power kills. Absolute power kills absolutely. This is the message emerging from this book on genocide and government mass murder, democide in the 20th century. By the way, can you notice here? There's Stalin in front of his picture. And who's next to him? Mao Tse-tung, Stalin. Here's Khrushchev, who became later dictator. But here they all are in front of this great Caesar worship. Or fairer worship, should we say. The more power government has, the more it can act arbitrarily, according to the whims and desires of the elite, and the more it will make war on others and murder its foreign and domestic subjects. The more constrained the power of governments, the more power is diffused, checked and balanced, the less it will aggress on others and commit democide. Totalitarian governments, communist governments, slaughtered their people by the tens of millions. In contrast, many democracies can barely bring themselves to execute serial murderers. I mean, isn't that absolutely bizarre? Most of the Western countries, they don't even have the death penalty for murder. Communist countries, you can be killed for nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's the reality of communism until 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell. Death by government includes numerous charts and tables, including the 15 most lethal regimes in terms of percentage of the population slaughtered. Cambodia, Turkey, Yugoslavia, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Soviet Union, Uganda, Angola, Romania, North Korea, and Mongolia. Maybe not the countries you would have expected, but that's in terms of the percentage of their population killed, going from worst down. Professor Rummel documents how these 15 mega murderers wiped out 151 million people, so he's just dealing with those 15 countries, almost four times as much as died in battle in all the wars of the 20th century combined. Now, this I'm taking from Operation World's Patrick Johnson's maps. You can see the Soviet Union, the red, and the extended, and you can see the communist regimes in Africa, including from, this is 1975. So, of course, Zimbabwe is not Zimbabwe, it's still Rhodesia, still Western aligned and so on. But you can see from Ethiopia and Aden and all the communist regimes down to Vietnam, because they've just taken South Vietnam in 1975. So you can see the extent. The blue represent NATO, shaded in blue means affiliated in a roundabout way and so on. This again is from Christians killed. This is not just people, this is Christians killed in the 20th century, according to Patrick Johnson's missiology statistics from Operation World. And of course, far and away, the Soviet Union gets the world prize. These are Patrick Johnson's statistics. Communists have killed more than half of all the people killed in the 20th century. The greatest killer of all has been communism, without a shadow of a doubt. In total, during the first 88 years of the 20th century, about 170 million men, women, children had been shot, beaten, tortured, knifed, burned, starved, frozen, crushed, worked to death, buried alive, drowned, hung, buried, or killed in any other of the many ways that governments have inflicted death on unarmed, helpless citizens and foreigners. The dead could conceivably be nearly 360 million people. This again, quoting from Professor Rummel's Death by Government. Our species has been devastated by modern black plagues, speaking about the bubonic plague in the Middle Ages, a plague of power, not of germs. Professor Rommel documents Stalin by far leads the list. He ordered the deaths of millions, knowingly set in train events leading to the deaths of millions more. And as the ultimate dictator, Stalin was responsible for still millions more killed by his henchmen, especially the Cheka, NKVD, KGB. Far above is the Gulag, the Soviet slave labor system created by Lenin, built up under Stalin. In some 70 years, it chewed up over 50 million lives. Death by Government documents that most of the victims of democide, 40%, are from Asia and the Middle East. The highest proportion of any region's population were from the territory of the former Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union and Red China account for most of the deaths by government in the 20th century. That Stalin, Lenin, and their successors murdered about 62 million Soviet citizens and foreigners is little comprehended outside the Soviet Union. Still quoting from Professor Rummel. Death by government calculates that between 35 million and 105 million people were murdered by the Communist Party of China from 1949 to 1987. And this is what they're celebrating this month in China, and probably many universities around the world too. Some other statistics in death by government include that the Japanese in the Second World War murdered about 5.8 million civilians, which was quite a surprise to me. Tito's communist partisans murdered at least 600,000 people in Yugoslavia. That's not counting once he took power, that's just while he was being supported by the British SOE, Special Operations Executive, which is well documented in The Secret War, Max Hastings' The Secret War, which is a colossal book I read last year, Spies, Codes and Guerrillas, 1939-1945. This covers the Second World War from the perspective of secret files which were sealed for 60 years in Britain, for example, GCHQ's files, and from the perspective of British, American military intelligence, and Soviet, Japanese, German military intelligence, French, Italian, and so on. And so, as a general who writes in the foreword says, this book requires every book and film and document in the Second World War to be rewritten in its entirety, because it's brought to the fore facts that completely change everything, because it's all the what was going behind the scenes, the lies and the code breaking and all the rest of it. Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge killed between 2 to 3 million Cambodians. Ottoman Turkey wiped out 1.7 million mostly Christian Armenians between 1909 and 1918, mostly in 1915. This is the Armenian genocide, which to this day Turkey refuses to admit, but it is the crime of the century, it was the first genocide of the 20th century, and the word genocide came to us from an Armenian describing what was happening back in 1915. And now we know that the Syrians lost 750,000 victims to the Turks and the Greeks 950,000 at that same time. And so 3.5 million mostly Christian people massacred by Ottoman Turkey in the name of jihad. The Armenians remember this. They've got a memorial in Armenia, the country of Armenia, which used to be part of the Soviet Union but now is an independent country. You might have heard of Nagorno-Karabakh, an island of Christianity in a sea of Islam, fought for their lives in the late 80s through 1990s. Massive, massive, massive war there. Nagorno-Karabakh is now linked to Armenia by a narrow corridor which they've carved out of Azerbaijan, which is a Muslim country, and they are determined to remember their people murdered by the Turks. Idi Amin's regime killed over 300,000 civilians in Uganda between 1971 and 1979. It didn't stop him being invited to the United Nations to address the UN and being elected chairman of the Organization of African Unity and all the rest of it. The Marxist MPLO, they say, wiped out 125,000 civilians in Angola. I would put it as well over a million, but I'm just quoting from Death by Government. The communist regime wiped out over 1.5 million people in Poland just between 1945 and 1948. Those were mostly Germans, actually, because a huge part of what today is Poland, about half of what today is Poland, used to be Germany and Prussia. And so they were just forcing them out and killing a whole lot of other people who weren't willing to leave. So it actually, while they were killed in what today is called Poland, they're almost all Germans. Professor Rommel concludes, as the arbitrary power of a regime increases massively, as we move from democratic through authoritarian to totalitarian regimes, the amount of killing jumps by huge multiples. Rommel's exhaustive documentation, Death by Government, exhibits the sheer lethality of power. That's political science. He also concludes that never has there been a war involving violent military action between stable democracies. Interesting theory. Indeed, we have here a general principle that's gaining acceptance, mainly that democracies don't or rarely make war on each other. I'm not sure about that, but interesting. To this, I would add, the less democratic two states are, the more likely it is they will fight one another. Well, maybe that's so, but it's not like you don't get democratic countries fighting one another, but I suppose it's certainly a lot worse when you get totalitarian countries. Still, you just take, for example, you would have said that Britain was something of a democracy in 1899, and the Boer Republics were definitely democracies, and yet the British could wage war against the Boer Republic, so I'm not too sure that all of this is quite right, but still, it's a theory. Power gradually extirpates, eliminates from the mind every humane and gentle virtue, quoting from Edmund Burke. Professor Rommel's colossal masterpiece, Death by Government, which wasn't an easy read or a happy read, but I did plow through it, conclusively proves that far from governments being the solution to crime and violence, historically governments have been the prime culprits for crime and violence. Far from governments being the solution, more often than not, they're the problem. I mean, just take the Congo. Patrice Lumumba slaughtered his people by the hundreds of thousands. Under the Kabila regime, the previous Kabila regime, millions died. You think of what's gone on all over the world. It's governments that kill their people more and more. It's not foreigners invading you that's the biggest problem. It's your own governments, which is why people need to be armed and people need to be having as much decentralization as possible. Most government policies to deal with crime and poverty are counterproductive. Just think, since America declared war on drugs, they've had more drugs. Since they've declared war on poverty, they've had more poverty. Since they've declared war on terror, they've got vastly more terrorism. It's just, whatever governments do, they make worse. I mean, historically, what we need is less government, not more government. Every genocide, every democide of the 20th century has been preceded by gun control and disarmament of civilians. Just as criminals prefer unarmed victims, tyrants prefer disarmed citizens. A government that doesn't trust their citizens with weapons cannot be trusted with power. Freedom is when government fears the people. Tyranny is when the people fear the government. No government can be trusted with a monopoly of force. Decentralization of power, such as in Switzerland, the rule of law, armed citizens are essential foundations for freedom. Nobody can oppress the people of Switzerland, for example. So what's the greatest killer? Communism, secular humanism, atheism. Just take the Berlin Wall as a classic concrete example of the failure of scientific socialism. To prevent Germans in the Soviet zone from fleeing to the Western zone Berlin, they built a 165-kilometer wall constructed to seal off West Berlin's island of freedom from communist East Germany. Talk about confessing your failure. When you've got to build a colossal obstacle course, the biggest obstacle course on the planet, in order to separate families, to separate people of the same language, same culture, from one another. And the wall got thicker, and they built bigger death strips, they demolished more and more of the buildings around the wall. They had 289 concrete observation posts, machine gun towers, and 123 kilometers of electric fencing just around West Berlin to keep it from keep their people in East Berlin escaping. You know the cost of about 1 meter electric fence, electricity-wise, is about the cost of a heater. So think of how many meters in all those kilometers, heater on all day, summer and winter. A further death strip stretching 1,393 kilometers of the border between communist East Germany and free West Germany was constructed, with 724 observation posts, machine gun towers, 1,161 kilometers of electric fencing, 54,000 self-firing devices, and 190 kilometers of minefields. Think what you could have done with that in terms of something good if you didn't have to stop your people from escaping the workers' paradise. Demolishing buildings and churches which are too close to the wall. Just between 13th of August 1961 and 30th of July 1983, 73 people were killed by the communists attempting to escape over the Berlin Wall, including Peter Fetcher here, 18-year-old, shot in the back by his own police for trying to go the day after his 18th birthday from East Berlin to West Berlin. 182 more people were killed attempting to escape from East Germany across the border into West Germany during that same time period. 60,000 people imprisoned for preparation, assistance, or complicity in attempting to escape from East Germany to West Germany. Sentences ranging from 16 months to life imprisonment for what you think is just free travel movement. Yet over 4 million Germans succeeded in escaping from East to West Germany, including 38,000 by tunnels, by improvised air machines, hot air balloons. There's even a Disney film on the hot air balloon escape. Hidden inside vehicles, including 2,768 East German soldiers and officers on duty, including a colonel escaping to the West. With some tremendous ingenuity and explosions and trucks driving through walls, and this chap managed to get people through with this truck, and oldest man to escape, I think he's 84. Youngest, he's 4 years old, coming up in the arms of his father from a tunnel under the wall. The hot air balloon is one of the Disney films. And one of the most famous, you'll see at our entrance, I've got Bill Bathman's favorite picture of this East German Bopo Volkspolizei escaping a checkpoint Charlie. From the founding of the German Democratic Republic, DDR. Remember, whenever you see the word democratic in a country's name, you know it's not. 4.5 million people, over a quarter of the population, voted with their feet by fleeing to the West. Now, I've smuggled through here. This is Checkpoint Charlie. I had to walk through this, where we were searched very severely. Of course, Bill Bathman would have driven through here many a time. Now, you see concrete blocks. Now, just watch. This is through the Eastern Bloc. This vehicle got through everything, and they finally got machine gun trying to get to the last obstacle. 7 people inside there. These are some escapes I've seen on video. Escapes from the West. Fiancé from East Berlin escaping to the West. fiance in the West had cut wires close to there, called up there at night, and she was able to, in fact, seeing her coming through, you can see her head gets caught on the barbed wire, and she's actually trying to stop the bleeding here. I've seen the actual 8mm film, but still smiling to escape. Okay, now, watching this. This man bought a car that would slip under the pole. He put his mother-in-law in the boot, his fiance in the back seat, and this man managed to escape, putting her down, swerving all the way around. I mean, that's a lot of swerving. This is a really Grand Prix thing with bullets flying. And they escaped successfully. And here he is with his fiance, showing how they had added these extra pillars to make sure that a person couldn't do that again. This lady is a seamstress, and her fiance here, she made Soviet uniforms for her future husband and for his friends, and they liberated a Soviet staff car, saluted at the gate here, they replicating this at Checkpoint Charlie, and drove straight out, acting like their Soviet officers who had the right to go through. Which, and she was lying underneath their feet and in the front. People escaped in many ways. You can just see the human spirit that refuses to be made a slave. The Iron Lady, Margaret Thatcher, said this about the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall stands as concrete proof that when people have a choice, they choose to be free. Freedom has its problems, but we've never needed to build walls to keep our people in. That's a great quote. Margaret Thatcher always knew how to put it well. Even during Gorbachev's much-acclaimed glasnost and perestroika in the 1980s, which people are all gaga about, the Soviet gulag imprisoned millions. When U.S. President Ronald Reagan stood at the Berlin Wall and challenged Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, at that very moment, the Soviet Union still operated 1,976 concentration camps, 273 prisons, 85 psychiatric prisons, which included Christians who were obviously off their mind because why would you believe in God if you know, scientific socialism and all that, 41 death camps. In the Soviet gulag were 5 million political prisoners, including 1 million religious prisoners, under Gorbachev, under Perestroika, under Glasnost. Not as bad as under Stalin's days, but not good. Alex Solzhenitsyn, the author of the Gulag Archipelago, documented that between 1918 and 1953, under Lenin and Stalin's rule, over 50 million Russians served long sentences, many perishing in the Soviet concentration camps. 2 Peter 2:19, while they promised them liberty, they themselves are slaves of depravity. Now there's a danger as we list these statistics and read these mind-numbing numbers of the victims of secular states. We can be hardened. Joseph Stalin said the death of one person is a tragedy. But the death of millions is just a statistic. Which is why we need to remind ourselves these were real people and whole families that were maimed, mutilated and murdered. If we were to add to the number of those victims murdered by their own governments in the 20th century, the pre-born babies who've been killed by abortion, and the old and sick people killed by euthanasia in secular states, the death toll would approach 1 billion people. I think it would be over 1 billion actually by now. Killed by secular human states in the 20th century alone. That's why the Bible says there's no one righteous, no, not one. There's no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They've together become worthless. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways. Now, the depravity of man is a universal truth. But in a place where they don't acknowledge God and they refuse to acknowledge God and they ban the Bible, the depravity of man increases exponentially worse in its manifestation. So Dr. James Kennedy observed in What If Jesus Had Never Been Born, the 20th century has been a century of mass murder, genocide and institutionalized terrorism. The fruits of the phantom faith in the secular state that persists in promising liberation, even as it attacks the most fundamental human attachments. The fool has said in his heart there is no God. They are corrupt. Their deeds are vile. There's no one who does good. This bitter harvest of atheism proves humanism is the most destructive religion in all of history. The secular state's the greatest killer ever. Secular states have made the 20th century the bloodiest century of all time. The enemies of God, though, are destined to defeat. Humanism is a self-destructive ideology. Evil will slay the wicked. Lenin is heading to the trash heap of history. In fact, many of his idols have already gone there. Starting in Leipzig, in Germany, spreading through Dresden to all of East Germany, the East German government was bankrupt and tottering as the Christians gathered in candlelight prayer vigils. This is the symbol of victory over communism, the candle. They'd come with candles, one person would have a lit candle, and would share in the light, would just spread and spread and spread. And this was a silent process, and people would switch all lights off in the home and just put a candle by an open window. And this symbolized the darkness of the light. Not all the darkness can put out the smallest light. My candle is more powerful in the darkness. Even a small candle is more powerful in darkness. Darkness cannot put out the light, but the light can banish the darkness where it progresses. And so this is the beginning. In fact, this is part of something that I barely realized until afterwards that I had seen the beginning of. When I came out of the military in end of 1981, I had the opportunity of seeing God Smuggler, Brother Andrew, at Hospital Christian Fellowship. The first mission I worked at Hospital Christian Fellowship was one of their board members, Brother Andrew. I'm sure he still is a board member. And so I heard him just before I went to the military, and I heard him just when I came out of the military. And before I went to the army, he was speaking at Hospital Christian Fellowship devotions, saying, "We're going to smuggle 1 million Bibles into China." I remember sitting there thinking, that's not possible. But they did. Operation Pearl, 1980. So next time I heard him, he had another harebrained scheme. He was saying, next year, 1982, we're going to launch a 7-year Jericho prayer march to bring down the Berlin Wall, the Iron Curtain, open up Eastern Europe and Russia for the gospel. I sat there also thinking, Brother Andrew really is off his rocker. I mean, there's just no way. I just couldn't even fathom the possibility. I'd seen the Berlin Wall. I'd been there. There's no way. It was coming down my lifetime. And so 1982, Brother Andrew launched this, which he said is not just praying for the persecuted church, it's praying with the persecuted church. The persecuted church is initiating this. We're joining them. And it started in Leipzig and spread through Dresden, spread throughout Eastern Europe. And there were some Christians in the West who observed it, but the Christians in the East were praying solidly for 7 years, saying a Jericho 7-year prayer march on bringing down communism in Eastern Europe. You can imagine, I was there in 1989, and I saw communism was as oppressive as ever. I went to the bathrooms behind the Iron Curtain, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Romania. No chance of this Berlin Wall coming down, but by the end of the year, that all toppled. Absolutely staggering. Gorbachev's Soviet Union went bankrupt, could no longer bail them out. Erich Honecker, dictator of East Germany, turned to West Germans. It always bailed them out, but at this occasion, Helmut Kohl was not going to bail them out. He demanded reforms first. The Berlin Wall fell. And while governments negotiated, the people in the East and the West rose up to breach the wall and began to physically dismantle the wall. General Mulder said he was in Berlin when it started. He was South African military intelligence, what they call a military attaché to the embassy in Berlin, and somebody said this happening. He raced over the wall and he could not believe it. It was the people literally taking on the wall in spite of all the machine guns and all the threats and the VOPOs, and they succeed. They pulled down the wall physically, and mass demonstrations broke out in Czechoslovakia. Václav Havel, long-time leader of the resistance movement, prisoner of the communists, rose to power, dismantled communism in Czechoslovakia. And the leaders were just overwhelmed by the events. The people sing Christmas carols on the wall. And you saw day after day different developments. People from East Germany for the first time allowed to travel to the West. And the Brandenburg Gate, symbol of the division of East and West Europe, breached. And down came the idols of Lenin and Dzerzhinsky, founder of the Czech. And here's bits of the Berlin Wall being dismantled. And the East German money being swept up and burned. Just worthless currency. Worthless. Just sweeping up. We wish I'd kept a few for tourism. They're worth a bit now as a sort of like Zimbabwe $100 trillion notes of interest. As far as Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, down came the idols of Lenin. Street fighting erupted in Romania to overthrow the brutal communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. The army joined the protesters in fighting the secret police. They cut out, I've got even here at the mission, one of these exercise flags that we've got in Romania, the communist hammer and sickle and red star and all that's cut out. And they overthrew the brutal dictatorship. People would put flowers in the barrels of the soldiers for joining their side. You see the white ribbon, that indicates joining the resistance. And at the beginning, the army, those who were fighting for the people, put the white ribbons with them. And you could see the people joining in with them. Let us never forget what communism has done in Russia and China and North Korea and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Poland and Romania, Bulgaria, East Germany, Albania, Cuba, Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, Afghanistan, Nicaragua, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe. The human cost of communism has been horrific. We must never trivialize it. The millions imprisoned in concentration camps, the hunger, the starvation, the civil wars, the persecution of Christians, the butchering of pastors, the destruction of churches, the burning of Bibles, the massacres, the fear and the horror. It's not very real to present generations, but for my generation, it's very real. We lived through it. We've got lots of friends who lived through it. Let's never forget the results of this evil, anti-Christ religion of communism, which is continuing to oppress people in China, North Korea, and Zimbabwe to this day. And may we be faithful to God's word, loyal to Christ, steadfast in our prayers for the suffering Christians. May we be brave and bold in opposition to communism. This is the face of resistance in Romania. By the way, the V is V for victory over communism, not peace. It's not the Western symbol. In Eastern Europe, that's a symbol for victory over communism. May we be brave in opposition to communism, bold in our proclamation of the truth of God's word. This is the passage that Richard Wurmbrand quoted live at a communist rally in the town hall in Bucharest, 1945 or 46, straight after the communists had taken over. They had a congress of cults and had one of the other church leaders going up on the platform saying, communism is Christianity. This is what Jesus taught, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. And one of the other went to the end. Sabina Wurmbrand turned to her husband, Lutheran pastor Richard Wurmbrand, said, go up and wipe the shame from the face of the Church of Christ. And Richard Wurmbrand said, you know, if I do that, you will be without a husband. And she said, I do not need a coward for a husband. And he went up and he quoted this passage. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? What communion is light with darkness? What accord is Christ with Belial? Or what part of the believer with an unbeliever? What agreement is the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk with them. I will be their God and they will be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean. I will receive you. As he said, he ended up in prison earlier than the others who had lied and compromised for the communists. But he said they ended up in the same prison he did, just a bit later. The difference was he had a clear conscience, they did not. On the 10th of October, we are having the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. Second Sunday in November every year is an International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. We've been part of it from the very beginning. It's been going for over 28, 29 years now, I think. And we run the idopafrica.org website. Of course, our church should be praying for the persecuted church all year round. But if we can at least get people to focus once a year, then hopefully some will do it more often. And so there's some great resources that we've produced. I think of just Bill Batham's books going on and going through, which are excellent. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? These are some of the resources I used to produce this presentation. Of course, Bill Batham's going through his absolute classic insight in what was going on behind the Iron Curtain at the time. We've got in the library this excellent film, which I got from the Ronald Reagan Library, In the Face of Evil. It's a big documentary on his war to defeat communism and bankrupt the Soviet Union, which he succeeded in doing in his presidency. Agenda and Agenda 2 are brilliant documentaries on understanding how communism works through education, Hollywood, and other parts of the world. To Evangelize Atheists, probably the very best video is The Atheist Delusion, absolutely outstanding, very comfort film. We've got our own documentary set up of Dr. Philip Stott's presentations on creation versus atheism. Also in our library, we've got films like Bitter Harvest, which are good dramas to help people to see the resistance of the Ukrainians against communism. Skalk Vaskalki's book, Under Fire, exposes what a policeman dealing with communist terrorism in our country had to see face up. For our farmers and families and missions and ministries who are living in a very dangerous time and place, Security and Survival Handbook is a practical book. Our newsletters, which regularly deal with communism, the persecuted church, and these kind of issues, there's a lot of videos and other materials on our frontlinemissionsa.org website. So, these are some of the upcoming. If you can recruit people to come to our Biblical Worldview Summit, that's a key time when we help to prepare people to resist communism. I trust people who go through our camps will not fall for the lies and deceptions of communism. So, any questions, any comments? Greatest Killer?
Yeah, just remember, once I was speaking to this UCT student, and he was saying how atheism is the solution for everything, and I was telling him how atheism has killed more people, and they showed the example of communism in Russia, and he was like, no! The president of Russia was atheist, but his government was religious. I'm like, what? He went, yes, of course.
They were religious atheists, yes.
He was like, no, that was not true atheism. Atheism would work perfectly in South Africa. I'm like, okay. Things like that.
It didn't work in Mozambique. Samora Michelle said he'd make the first truly atheistic country in Africa. Didn't work in Albania. Enver Hoxha said he'd make the first truly atheistic country in Albania. In fact, he killed the last minister. There wasn't one church, not one minister in Albania. Enver Hoxha even banned all cats from the capital city. I'm not sure what cats have to do with it, but I think they don't obey orders. So, and when I visited Albania, would you know it, in the capital city, cats found me. And I was happy to give them milk and things like that. But extraordinary. There's every one of these nations we've been mentioning, they did it in the name of atheism, scientific socialism and atheism. So a person who denies that is, I was in a university in Milwaukee where someone claimed, no, Stalin was a Christian. He did all those things in the name of Christianity. You know, I don't think you know the first thing about history of Russia and the Soviet Union. He's literally trying to say, no, Stalin was a Christian. Well, he might have been brought up one, but he certainly rejected that all, and he was doing everything in the name of atheism. Mm. That was the state religion. That was their number one goal, was promotion of atheism. Mm. That's why after the cosmonaut circled the globe, he came back, and they sent him on a propaganda tour through the schools to say, I've been into the heavens and I can report to you there's no God. He had just done a little circuit around the world. He hadn't gone that far. When you think of how big the universe is, it's a bit pathetic. But apparently there's a brave girl in one school who stood up and said, but comrade, the Bible says only the pure in heart will see God. Comments, observations, criticisms.
And that little girl was the
candy. Exactly. Yeah. Atheism doesn't have a chance. But they've managed to dominate the 20th century and cause a lot of havoc.
These supposed great minds who compared the wonderful creation of human beings to grains of sand and rotting mushrooms and... Did they even realize that
fungus.
They were talking about themselves?
Probably. I'm sure they have a bad self-image too. They said the national sport in the Soviet Union was drinking vodka. And you can imagine it was about the only thing that they could do is get drunk. It's a horrible existence. And the people tried to find something they could excel in. And there was very, very little that you could do. One of the things was to compete in the Olympics, but then you had to be really, really, really dedicated. And if you didn't do well, you were in trouble. If you did well, you got all the privileges of being a party member. So, you know, during the Cold War, it was so often where it would be an East German or a Russian who was winning. And then you suddenly didn't hear, the moment they introduced drug testing, drugs and performance enhancement, suddenly they didn't feature. But so they were obviously pumping them full of every kind of... In fact, a lot of the women, if you go back and you look in the 1970s and 80s, some of the women competing, and you look and think, yuff, they must have pumped them full of all kinds of male hormones, and they didn't even look like women. They looked like some heavyweight wrestler types. And so it was used as such a propaganda war. And but you learn from people like Nadia Comaneci. She is the first person to win a 10 in ballet. Was it ballet or gymnastics? Gymnastics, right. 1972, the Munich Olympics, from Romania, but she told how her life was a living hell from age 4. She is targeted, you will win at the Olympics. I think she is age 12 by then. So she had for 8 years nothing but, I mean, every waking moment, what she ate, what she did, it was just, her life was dedicated to winning the Olympics in 1972. And so she had no childhood, no anything. It was just, everything was, and that's, so the Olympics were meant to be non-professionals, amateurs. But the communist states, there was no such thing as amateurs. And so they should have been disqualified, but they weren't. And so what you had is amateurs in the West against professionals with the full weight of the state and no expenses spared. And they would go to the primary schools, and no, preschools, and they'd be selecting the people already for who would be in whatever particular discipline. And then that's all their entire life would be focused on this, just to win, to beat the West at something and to stand the podium, have the national, and, you know, propaganda boost. You know, we win again, the great new socialist man. So these poor people, I mean, they had wrecked lives as a result of it. If they won, then they got privileges, yeah. But Nadia Comaneci, her story is actually quite tragic, because the moment she won, suddenly the son of the dictator Ceausescu took an interest in her, and she is abused. And she later fled to America, defected, taken her American citizenship. She feels traumatized by Romania. I mean, imagine it, the national heroine. The whole world sort of thinks she's the greatest gymnast the world had ever seen. Nobody had ever seen a performance that perfect. The first 10 in history at Olympics and gymnastics. But later when she told what life had been like to get there, I mean, none of us would have wanted to pay that price.
Lenin and Stalin, how did that power partnership work?
There was no partnership. Lenin was the dictator. Stalin was a kind of nothing. The fact that you have a picture of him sitting next to Lenin, you'd think that Lenin and Stalin were friends. They weren't really. In fact, Lenin even warned, don't let this bank robber, Stalin, get, because that was what he did. He wasn't even part of the revolution. He came in later. Trotsky was the favorite of Lenin, who was meant to be the number two, who was going to be the next leader when Lenin came to power. And Stalin was too clever for him. I mean, they all underestimate Stalin. So Stalin was not, there was no partnership. They've got this one picture of Lenin and Stalin sitting together, and maybe Stalin even organized this photograph to be taken where it looked like they were friends, but they weren't. Lenin didn't trust him. Not that Lenin was a good man, but... But to be fair, Stalin killed more communists than probably anyone else. Sadly, killed a lot of our people too, but he wiped out some of the best communists there were, like Trotsky. So... This is the thing about communism, that don't know when to stop. You could say that the biggest enemy of Rhodesia, Josiah Tonkagoro, the head of ZANLA, he was murdered by Mugabe, 1979, just the day after Christmas, 26 December 1979, because Josiah Tonkagoro was going to be the first president. Everyone knew, if ZANU won an election, Mugabe is nothing. He's a politico. He'd never picked up a rifle or done any fighting. So Tonkagoro was the hero. Next thing, he gets killed, and Robert who? In he comes. Michelle did the same thing with Eduardo Mondlane, the founder of FELIMA. To her dying day, Winnie Mandela claimed, and to this day, General Bartolomisa claims that the murder of Chris Hani was an inside job, which Mbeki and Zuma were part of. Because Chris Hani, head of the Southern Communist Party and head of Umkhonto we Sizwe, was the charismatic, well-spoken... To be honest, I've heard Nelson Mandela speak in public. I've heard Chris Hani speak in public. I've debated them both. Chris Hani is far and away, vastly better speaker, far more charismatic. Chris Hani was going to be the second president. I mean, Mandela they built up, he's going to be the first president. Chris Hani is going to be number two. Next thing, Chris Hani gets assassinated on the one day that they took his bodyguards away. Who was responsible for his bodyguards? Thabo Mbeki. And just the timing. Okay, they blame some poor guy from Poland. He gets blamed and so on. And spends life in prison. But the ANC in a group say this was done by Mbeki and Zuma, who knew they had no chance at the presidency as long as Chris Hani was alive. Now, I've just named a few, but there's, in fact, you can go to every communist revolution, and there was the snowball that Napoleon later assassinated to get into power. It's, you have the guy who does the work, yes, that can go. You have the person who does the work, and then just before they get into power, some politico assassinates them to get the position. This is classic communism. And that's why I think for these people out there who think that working for the party, one for all for one, they don't realize they're the first ones who are going to get it in the neck. Because they might be good for doing a revolution, but when the politicos take over, they don't want someone who knows how to do a revolution getting rid of them when they fail to fulfill their promises. And that's why I think it's important for us to reach communists with this message that they understand they're being used. I mean, the foot soldiers of the communist revolution are going to be betrayed. They always are. Stalin killed all the faithful supporters of Lenin. Not that I'm crying for them, but, you know, just it's a fact.
In a way, the animal farm isn't just applicable to Russia, it's applicable to any...
Oh, yeah, it's the gold standard. I think it's just... Because it's human nature, and it's the nature of revolution. It's the way revolutions work.
Yeah. Yes. I remember when we handled it in school, our teacher told us that even the Zimbabweans held on to animal farm and said yes. That it was written for them.
It is. I've spoken to people in Gola, in Mozambique, Romania, they all know Animal Farm. I mean, it's like, this is the sort of humor that keeps them going, this satire, because they recognize it all around them.
Yeah.
There's some great sense of humor over in Eastern Europe. So, for example, going to Eastern Europe, one of the jokes I heard early on was, there are five contradictions in a communist country. This is from Paul Negruț in Romania. He says, in a communist country, nobody works. But the five-year plan is always accomplished. The five-year plan is always accomplished, but the market is empty. But the people always have enough to eat. People always have enough to eat, but nobody's satisfied. Nobody's satisfied, but we always applaud. The five contradictions of a communist country. Now, if you're in a communist country, that's how it works. And then a person said, in Moscow, a man lost his parrot. He was absolutely petrified. He was running through the streets trying to find his parrot. In the end, he went to the Lubyanka, that's KGB HQ, to report his parrot is missing. I said, go away, we don't care about your parrot. I said, yes, comrades, I understand that. But if you find him, I want to know. I completely disagree with all my parrot's opinions. And there's another one about three people in a concentration camp, boxcar on the way to the prison, and so they're discussing it. Why are you here? This man says, I was 5 minutes late for work and they accused me of sabotage. Why are you here? And I was 5 minutes early for work. They accused me of espionage. So I asked the other one, why are you here? He says, I was on time. I saw my watch was made in West Germany. In other words, the only way you could be on time is if you had a Western watch, because the Eastern watch don't work well. These are the sorts of... So then there was another one that we heard in Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia, this man was depressed, so he went to the psychologist. And he was shocked how many people were there. And waiting room just packed out, so he gets a number, sits down, he waits. And late in the day, by the time he gets to the doctor, he says, Doctor, I'm sorry, I've forgotten what I was here for. Doctor, it's only what happens all the time. Was it a housing problem? She said, no, we've got 40 square feet and there's only my mother and mother-in-law and grandfather, five children, wife and I. We've got more space than most people do. Is it a work problem? She said, no, there's no raw materials or there's no electricity, so there's no work at work. Is it a financial problem? No, he says, there's nothing in the shops to buy anyway, so. He said, is it a domestic problem? That's it, he says. My wife and I can't agree. My wife says communism scientific. I say it's political. Which of us is right? So the psychologist gets up, he turns the taps on, turns up the radio, leans up, says, you're right. It's political. If it was scientific, they would have experimented in animals first. Now, these are the kind of jokes you get in these things. But that's the way they say, and they've got all these. So another one got in Romania. They said, when I arrived, they said, there's this American dog, there's a Romanian dog, and there's a Russian dog. And so the American dog says, you know, I just love, all I've got to do is bark, and my owners throw me another chunk of meat. So the Romanian dog scratches his ear, says, what's meat? And the Russian dog says, what's bark? So after the wall came down, visited, and this chap says, oh, those three dogs are still talking. So the American dog says, you know, these days things are so good, Ronald Reagan and all this, I get twice as much meat as I used to get. And the Russian dog says, you know, things have gotten better for us. We now get fed and we're allowed to bark. And the Romanian dog says, well, they've doubled the length of my chain. I said, that's good. He says, yes, but the food belt's still another meter further. So it's those sort of things that you'd ask them a question, they'd give you a joke. I'm sure that's sort of like the Zimbabweans have to be. They can't give a straight answer. When they told me about some atrocity that had been done against some, they'd actually tried to kill someone in the church. And the pastor's whole electrical things had been wired by somebody who came in without them even requesting, had to do the rewiring. And when he came back, he saw that the wires were, even his, what do you call it, the pipes outside the home, metal pipes, were glowing and the steam was coming off. The snow was evaporated. And so he suspected something, got a friend who knew electricity, and so they'd actually wired it up so that if he touched that, he would be electrocuted, dead. There's no shorting or anything. So, you know, did you report it? Yes. I said, well, what's happened? So he said, well, you know, there were these sheep and they got torn to pieces by wolves, and a delegation of sheep went to the king of the beasts, the lions, to complain about this abuse by the wolves. And so the lion was very compassionate and understanding, and he said, I'll send an investigation team. And he said, late that day, the team investigators arrived, but they were all wolves.
Oh.
So that's the kind of answer you get. The people who do the atrocities are the ones who come to investigate later. So, exactly, this is the kind of bunch. So when people want to come up with the greatest killer and so on, we've got a whole lot of authorities. There is just no doubt whatsoever. Communism, secular humanism, atheism, but communist dictators take the cake, and Mao Zedong and Joseph Stalin are sort of vying up there for who's the greatest mass murderer of all time. But that's not what Hollywood gives us, and that's not what our school textbooks gives us. Sort of wonder whose side they're on.